Now, I'm looking around, and I want to be sure I haven't overlooked anyone. Today's the Sabbath when we traditionally conduct our blessing of little children ceremony. Over the years, we've been different numbers at a time. Sometimes we've had several, and today in Wheeling and Pittsburgh both, we don't really have any young children to be blessed. But it's a special day. It's one that parents are particularly excited and nervous about. I remember the times when our two children were blessed, very nervous about what they had to have on their newest, most special little outfit, and just hoping they weren't going to erp or load their diaper up at the wrong time or get sleepy or cranky. But somehow with all the anxiety built into it, it all comes out well, and it's this very special time for the parents. And the children are not really aware of what's happening, but it really is a special time for them as well. Now, the date for the blessing of little children was chosen, frankly, out of convenience. It's chosen to be at a time when everyone hopefully is back home from the Feast of Tabernacles, the second week following the feast. It's done on this Sabbath so that all of the congregations of the church can participate in it at the same time. Of course, the blessing of little children, again, the date is chosen for out of convenience, but it's not like that was a date that the Scripture tells us we have to do it. In other words, children can be blessed on other occasions as well. I've done that. I've gone to individuals' homes to bless their children, or done it at services in a private room. It's not something that has to be done on a particular date. Again, it's chosen for convenience of the parents and for the church members. But the blessing of little children is a comforting and heartwarming ceremony. It's so encouraging to us to note that Jesus Christ was willing to take the time to take little children into his arms at the parents' request and ask a very special and personal blessing upon them. And so we have developed the ceremony that we have to follow that example. It highlights something that's very special to us and yet very familiar, and then possibly even something that we mostly take for granted, and that is our family relationship. It's a relationship that God has given to us that we enjoy, and it's a way that our lives are structured. But again, it's so familiar to us that we may not give a whole lot of thought to us, or to it. It's important, and I think helpful, to remember that marriage and the family relationship were established from the very beginning. In fact, as we read the first couple of chapters, we see that God created marriage and the family relationship. We make the point in the marriage ceremony that we have for the church that marriage is not a man-made institution. It's not just some good idea that somebody came up with that, hey, here's a thought, let's get together, and there's me, there's you. No, that's not the way marriage came about. God created the marriage relationship, and he created it for the purpose of perpetuating families. The family is the foundation and the structure of our lives. It helps us as well to understand the spiritual and the eternal family that God is in the process of creating. We also should know, of course, that when God established marriage and family, he also established laws that preserve this fundamental relationship. He intended for it to be something that would continue throughout the ages. And interestingly, it has, hasn't it? In every culture, in every age, there has been family. It's a universal building block for society. Now, certainly in other places, other times, the specific structure of it may have been a little different. But where those changes were introduced, they were not necessarily following the laws that God had given. But the family structure remains intact. And it's a universal structure. It reminds me somewhat of this, of the weekly cycle. God created as well, as we know in the first few verses of Genesis 2, he created the Sabbath day. And in doing so, he created the seven-day cycle. And for all the different things that have happened throughout the history of mankind, all the confusion, all the difficulties, all the wars, the dark ages, all the things that have happened throughout the whole history of mankind, that seven-day cycle has never been broken. We know when the Sabbath is. And we know to observe the Sabbath on the seventh day. In a similar way, the family structure has never been broken. Now, there are broken families. There are people who have difficulties. There are situations that are not really what God would have designed it to be. But the family itself, that structure has remained permanently a part of man's history and will be part of our future as well. So God, when he established family, established laws that we can be aware of to preserve that fundamental and basic relationship. The title of the sermon this afternoon is God Protects the Family. The family is, we can look at many different aspects of God's creation, and we're amazed by what God has done in his wisdom and in his genius. And the family is part of his creation. We're going to review initially here this afternoon several verses that are familiar to us in the first and second chapters of Genesis to establish God's creation of marriage. And we'll move from that point on to see the laws that he had put in place to preserve family and marriage. Let's begin in chapter 1, verse 26. Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. The first 25 verses in this chapter review what we understand to be the recreation or the setting in order of the earth and the reestablishing of that creation that had been defiled by the rebellion of Lucifer. And as he completed putting those elements back in place, he comes to verse 26. God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish in the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And then God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it," or control it, manage it. "Have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and every living thing that moves on the earth." God created mankind for a very special purpose. When he says, "Let us make man in our image," the Hebrew doesn't imply just a male gender individual, but the intent is mankind. God created mankind after his image. And he created mankind in a very special step or stage of the creation. It always irritates me when I hear people say, and they often do, that man is just another kind of animal. That we're listed here and we're just another form of animal that exists on this earth. Man is not an animal. Mankind was made in the image of God, for the purpose of God. Animals were made after their own kind and after their own species. They were to be controlled and managed by man, by mankind. God gave mankind the authority to manage and control what he had created. And we are created not after the animal kind. And you can see that term used. They're created after their own kind or species. But we were created after the God kind. And animals reproduce within their species or within their kind. When we understand what God's purpose is, we know that he is reproducing himself through us or through mankind. So we are made after the God kind. We're not an animal. I know that you know that, but I think it bears emphasis from time to time that the people say that kind of thing, and it's just really a complete misunderstanding of what God is doing. Drop down to chapter 2, verse 7. Now, in chapter 2, we find kind of a summary for most of the chapter, and with some detail added to what the creation was that is described in chapter 1. So it's kind of backtracking a bit to give some detail of what happened on day 6 of that creation. In verse 7, it says, "The eternal God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being." God created the first man, and this time he's given the name Adam. He was created from the ground. He was formed from the dust of the ground, and life was given to him. Drop down then to verse 18. Another important point that we find here says, "The eternal God said, 'It is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him.'" I don't believe this was just God. Oops, I just thought of something. I got this man here, and I probably shouldn't leave him by himself, so I think I'd better create something else. No, God didn't overlook creating the woman, but he wanted to do so in a particular way to help Adam understand what he was being given as a gift from God. Remember, we saw in verse 26 that God said, "Let us make man in our image, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea." And that he created male and female, both in his image. So God intended, God planned, God was always going to create the woman as well, but he had not done so at this point. Something was still missing. Adam needed a helper comparable to him. Adam needed a companion that was on his level, someone who could meet his needs. So God wanted to provide that, but he wanted Adam to understand just how special that gift would be. Verse 19, "Out of the ground the eternal God formed every beast of the field, every bird of the air, and he brought them to Adam to see what he would call them. And whatever Adam called each living creature, that was its name." First of all, note that the animals, like Adam, were created out of the ground. And as God did so, he brought these creatures before Adam. Two reasons, or maybe more than that. But for one thing, Adam now was able to see the handiwork of God and to appreciate what all God had created. And I'm sure that as he saw these creatures, he probably paused and puzzled over some of them. Maybe he had to ask a little bit, "Well, I don't know what to name it because I don't know what it does. What is that? And what is it supposed to be? What is it to me? What is it to this world that you put me in?" So it probably took some time, and Adam sorted through all the different creatures that were brought to him, and probably chuckled at some, and probably was big-eyed and amazed at others, but he was able to learn enough about each one to give it a name. But for Adam, there was not found a helper comparable to him. There was no suitable companion for Adam. And that's the point that God wanted to make. God wanted Adam to understand that of all these things that you've seen, and as amazing as they are, there's nothing here that's really a proper and suitable companion for you. He'd seen all the animals. You've probably known people who seem to love animals more than people. Sometimes animals can be a little easier to get along with than people are generally. Animals are more compliant. They're easier to control. And so people can relate to them a little more directly. Frankly, I'm a dog person. I'm not so much a cat guy. Some people love cats. I don't have anything against cats, but I don't really, I'm kind of neutral. Cat, you know, it doesn't really matter that much to me. But I really enjoy dogs. We had a dog for several years. I've mentioned him often to you in the past. He gave us companionship and entertainment. He was affectionate. He was faithful. He was playful. He was a goofy little guy, and his name was Ernie. I always thought we could have named him Chuckles, because whatever kind of a mood I was in, Ernie would always bring a smile, and it always make you feel just a little better. And so I really came to enjoy our dog Ernie. But you know what? I don't think he was so much a compatible companion in the same way that what God was trying to provide for Adam. Now, I know some of you love cats, and that's fine for you. Some people connect to horses. You know, they really feel you have a real connection with that, with a horse. There was a member out in one of our congregations in Oregon who had a fish tank or a terrarium above in the headboard of his bed, and he kept stored in it a couple of big old full-grown tarantulas. And those were his, he had them named. I didn't ever learn their names. Didn't care to. But he would lovingly feed them little insects and things. I mean, he would take them out, let them crawl around on his arm. And he offered to let them crawl on my arm. And I telephoned him on my way home that, no, thank you. I don't want to have tarantulas crawling around on me. But dogs, cat, horses, spiders, they're not people. And people relate to them and they find some companionship with them. But God created people to need people. And our connection for our relationships is with other people. And God was proving that to Adam, proving to him that something was missing. Of all the creatures that God created, as amazing as they are, there was nothing really like him. And God wanted Adam to appreciate the special blessing that he was about to give to him. Verse 21. The eternal God caused a deep sleep to fall on Adam, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh in its place. Then the rib which the eternal God had taken from man, he made into a woman, and he brought her to the man. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." God here again demonstrated to Adam that he had not yet, to this point, created a being that would be comparable or suitable as a companion for him. And he did so in a very special act of creation. The woman was not made from the ground, like Adam was, and like all the other animals were. The woman was made from man. The woman had the same DNA as Adam, except for the Y chromosome. Adam immediately recognized that this is more like it. That's what I've been looking for. Let me read verse 23 again from the New Revised Standard Version because I think it states it more clearly. Then Adam said, "This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh." In other words, finally, here is someone like me. And he said, "This one will be called woman, for out of man this one was taken." Now, it's a play on words in the Hebrew. You may be familiar that the Hebrew word for woman is isha, and the Hebrew word for man is ish. And isha means out of ish. In other words, the woman came from or out of the man. So at last, after all this we've been through, all these creatures that have come by, at last, here is someone like me. Finally, I found someone just like me, except it's a girl. And that made it even more special. This was God's purpose from the start, to create a man and a woman to be brought together in a marriage relationship and to have a family and to begin a new cycle of life. But he wanted to emphasize to Adam that his wife was a special blessing to him. And I think that's one of the most important lessons for us in every generation to remember. That God, in his love, has given us, as men and women as well, he's given each of us someone who is comparable to us, someone who is a suitable companion. And there's nothing else in this creation that can serve that purpose. He wants husbands to realize what a special blessing from God their wives are. It says that the woman was to be his helper. Now, what does that mean? There's a lot of issues between men and women. I think Satan has introduced that and caused some confusion in the relationships. And in many ways, women have been not treated fairly in different cultures and different times. And it's a struggle that they have even to some extent now. So was the woman created inferior to the man? The man was the man, but the woman is just the helper. You know, if you're on a construction job and you're the guy who knows what you're doing and what you're building, what's going on, you've got these laborers. They're just helpers. They're there to dig holes and to carry stuff around and to do the grunt work. Is that what God meant when he said that Eve, or the woman, was to be his helper? Well, thankfully, that's not it at all. That's not the way that word is used in this case. For one thing, God had told Adam to multiply and replenish the earth. Without Eve, it wasn't going to happen, was it? This was not something he could do by himself. The woman was created to be a helper to the man. And when we consider it, we understand that men and women each help the other. That we complement, that we fill in the gaps in each for each other to make us whole. God created both male and female in his image. Remember, we read that in chapter 1, verse 26. So God did not create one inferior to the other in terms of the purpose of their creation. The word help that's used here has a fuller meaning. The Hebrew, it means to make it easier for someone to do something by offering one's services or resources. That's pretty basic explanation or definition. To offer aid or assistance. It also means to make something less severe or more pleasant. God has made our lives much more pleasant by creating the marriage and family relationship. Being a helper is not a negative thing. After all, think about it. Who is your greatest helper? A helper is not necessarily inferior. Who do you look to the most to give you help? Turn back to Psalm 33, verse 20. Psalm 33, verse 20. It's a lengthy psalm. I'm going to break into it just to make the point that we're talking about now. Psalm 33, verse 20. Our soul waits for the eternal. He is our help and our shield. Are you superior to God? God helps us. He intervenes for us. He does things for us. He makes circumstances less severe or more pleasant. He lends his services to us, and we rely upon him. Being a helper is not a negative thing at all. And again, Psalm 70, verse 5. And these are just a couple. There are many other passages that remind us that God is one that we can turn to when we're in need for the help that we must have. Psalm 70, verse 5. This is a psalm of David. He says, "But I am poor and needy. Make haste to me, O God. You are my help and my deliverer." Now, a wife is not a deliverer and a help in the same way that God helps us. But the point I want to make is that being a helper is not an inferior role. It is a position of responsibility in the life that God has given us to share. The man by himself is incomplete. He needs help. Women, I guess, realize more than we men do. You guys need some help here. And that's kind of the women are there to give us that to supply and to help and to be a compatible companion and to serve us. And we are to serve them. And that's also something that comes out later in Scripture. The word comparable that's used here in this verse, I think we're in verse 218. The word comparable or the word meet, M-E-E-T, is used in the King James. It's from a Hebrew word which means corresponding to or in exact correspondence. So one that is comparable is one who corresponds to or who meets the need of another. Again, we might use the word complementary. We fill in the gaps, or we might use the word compatible, that we together can combine to make a whole. And that's the way that God created the man and the woman to function in a marriage. Neither the man nor the woman is complete without the other. The physical differences are obvious between men and women, but the emotional differences are more subtle, but just as important. I find it really humorous even, and maybe a bit frustrating, that people want to insist that there's really no difference between men and women. They're really not paying much attention, are they? Even, and again, you've noticed this with your children, and we have with ours and with our grandchildren. You know, our grandson, Kyle, was all boy from the moment he was born. And our granddaughter, Brooke, was all girl from the moment she was born. There is a difference between male and female. God created it. It's part of what he established here. We see the creation of Adam. We see the creation of the woman, who's later named Eve. And God made them to fill a specific role that is compatible and comparable and suitable, that they can live together in the way that he designed. Back in Genesis 2, look at verse 24. Genesis, the second chapter, verse 24. We've reviewed some of the highlights of the creation of man and of woman as we find it here in this chapter. Therefore, chapter 2, verse 24. Now, I usually alert you when we come to the word therefore, because that means we're coming to a conclusion. That means, based on what we've just seen, based on what we've learned, based on what has just been said, there's a conclusion that's about to come. The reason that God went through this process was so that a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. This is the whole point of the creation of man and then the creation of woman. Now, these aren't Adam's words. He didn't make this statement. Frankly, at this point in his life, he was just still taking it all in, just still learning what all these animals were. And now there's this woman that's been... He didn't know the process that was going to take place at that point. These words were written by Moses when he put together the book of the law. He wrote these books in Scripture, and they were inspired by God. It shows the origin of men and of women, of the creation of the institution of marriage, where a man and woman come together to start to be their own family. It says that they're to be joined to, he is to be joined to his wife. The word in Hebrew that's translated here, to be joined to, means to cling. It says in the New King, in the King James, he uses the word cleave. Cleave unto his own wife. It means to cling or to hold on to with energy. It means to stay with. And God brought them together, a man and a woman, to leave their own families and become joined as one and to have children of their own. The cycle is described. It's very simple. It's kind of like shampoo. Wash, rinse, repeat. So families have children. They get married and have families and have children. The process repeats. God created that institution to be part of man's culture, to be the foundation of our society. Isn't it interesting that the birth rate of males compared to females is almost exactly equal? There's a slightly higher rate of male children that are born compared to female babies. Now, the death rate is a little different for males and females as well. The male population tends to be thinned out a bit more over time, basically because of the role they play and the difference in the way that they live. But it all comes together and it averages out so that there's never a lack of one or the other so that families can be continued. That really goes contrary to the theory of evolution, doesn't it? Evolution would tell us that the stronger member of the species would dominate and probably would there be more of them. You know, a man can have several wives. We'll talk about that in a minute. But in other words, there wasn't a need in terms of the way evolution supposedly progressed for that number to be so close to even. It's just one more little bit of evidence that God intended for the family to continue from one generation to the next throughout all of mankind's development. Again, we tend to take all this for granted until we stop to think about it and to realize that God has created it. We live this way, and it's the way we know to live, but God gave it to us as a gift, really, so that we can live together in peaceful circumstances, perpetuate the humankind, and play that part in the eventual development of God's spiritual family. Now, we know that Adam and Eve exercised their independence by choosing to not follow God's instruction, as described in the very next chapter. Mankind has chosen that same route, to not follow God's instruction, and that has complicated the family relationship. The family relationship is sometimes a difficult one, not because God intended it to be that way, but because of the sins and the mistakes that people have made. Maybe even people in our own families have made mistakes that have made sometimes life difficult. Mankind has chosen to choose other forms of marriage. What is marriage? People like to argue about that. What is marriage? Genesis 2, verse 24 makes it pretty clear. A man, a woman, they come together and they form their own relationship. They are joined together. The word joined here also, I need to emphasize, the word joined to also means to stay with, to remain together. There's no place in this description of the institution of marriage and family, there's no place for divorce. Now, I know it's happened. I know that it's touched our lives. And that's not necessarily something that we condemn. But the point is that God did not intend initially, when he created this institution, when he created the family, divorce wasn't part of it. They're joined together. They come together in the most intimate possible relationship. That's why man needed someone compatible. And woman needs someone compatible. They shall become one flesh. They are to be joined together and to both physically and emotionally become completely and totally bonded. That's the relationship that God created. But mankind, again, has complicated that by choosing their own way, by allowing indiscriminate divorce, by same-sex relationships, by polygamy. There are all kinds of different manners in which the family has been reshaped outside of what God created. Now you're going to ask me about Abraham and Jacob and David and these men, heroes in the Old Testament who had several wives. Don't ask me that question. Seriously, we do see that in Scripture, don't we? We see how God, what God created, but we see later that there were some who had more than one wife. I'll just make two comments about that. First of all, you see that their family life was a mess. David had, what, about four wives? He had sons who tried to kill him. He had people that tried to overthrow his throne. Jacob had two wives and two concubines, and his own sons were turning against each other as they developed. Abraham was married apparently just to Sarah for many years, but then he took in Hagar, and that's when his life became much more difficult. So the example of Old Testament patriarchs having more than one wife is not a good one. We see, actually, in there as examples why it's not a good thing and what the problems are that can develop. And we also, seriously, just need to leave that to God to judge. He allowed things to happen. David was a man after God's own heart, and yet he made some pretty serious mistakes. So I don't think we should be confused by what others did in the Old Testament. We should look at the instruction and the way it was designed to be and the way that God intends for it to be. And he'll judge and sort out the others. Now, when it was important to preserve mankind, who did God choose? He chose Noah, who had one wife, three sons. They each had one wife. And God brought that family through the flood to, again, repopulate the earth. So he didn't bring some confused situation into the earth, into the situation after the flood. So I wouldn't get too concerned about why did God allow certain things. We'll have to let him tell us the answer to that. Jesus Christ and the Apostle Paul both confirm the original law of marriage. Let's look at Matthew 19, verse 4. Matthew 19, verse 4. Jesus is answering a question that was asked of him in verse 3. The Pharisees asked him as a test. They said, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason?" See, that was part of the culture of that time. If a husband was dissatisfied with his wife over anything, then he was allowed to divorce her. It could be something very trivial, very minor. But he was allowed to divorce his wife based on just almost any reason at all. So they wanted Jesus to answer that question. They were testing him. They apparently, probably thought, well, whichever way he answers this, we got him. You know, we'll be able to catch him in something. So Jesus answered them in verse 4, "Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female?" And we just read this from Genesis 1 and 2. And he said, "For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." Again, remember that to be joined to means to stay with, to be a permanent relationship. "So then, they're no longer two, but one flesh." They become one by the act of marriage. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate. So that was the answer straight from Scripture that Jesus gave to the Pharisees. And they turns out they didn't get him after all, did they? Because he answered them from Scripture. He supported the original establishing, the original law of marriage that was established at creation. Now, we know that in the church teaches, we have a doctrine on this point, that there are some very limited circumstances under which, or within which, it is allowable for a person to be divorced and then to remarry. But those are very restricted and isolated circumstances, and we can talk about that at another time. But divorce was not intended to be part of the arrangement that God created and that he set up and established initially. Let's quickly look at another part of Scripture. We understand that the law, the Ten Commandments, are divided into 4 and 6. The first 4 describing how to love God, how to worship him, and the last 6 describing how people relate to each other, how we treat one another. Notice that 3 of those last 6 commandments, half of the commandments that deal with personal relationships, have to do with the preservation of marriage and family. I think it shows an emphasis of why or that it is very important to God. 3 of those 6 commandments specifically directly relate to preserving and protecting family and marriage. Let's look at them briefly. Exodus 20, verse 14. Exodus 20, verse 14. We read here that you shall not commit adultery. Very simple, very direct command, one that I think is easy for us to understand. But for some reason, not easy for people to abide by. Adultery is a married individual cohabiting with someone other than his or her spouse. And that is prohibited. Again, joined to means to be with your spouse and for that relationship not to be shared with anyone else. Even though the commandment is given here in Exodus 20 at the time when Israel had left Egypt, we know that the law existed from the beginning. The law prohibiting adultery existed from the beginning. For example, in Genesis 12 and again in Genesis 20, we find circumstances where Abraham had told a kind of a half lie about Sarah, claiming that she wasn't his wife but his sister, and in both of those cases put her in jeopardy of someone taking her to be their wife. So Abraham was in effect denying that he was married to Sarah. But in both cases, it was even a well-known law in society that a man could not take another man's wife. That was adultery. It wasn't allowed. And so the prohibition against adultery was not just added here at the time that Israel came from Egypt. It was always part of the connection, the trust, the uniqueness of a relationship between a husband and a wife. Adultery is one of the most devastating sins that a person can commit. It's a violation of the relationship that God had established of one man being joined to one woman. It can destroy the marriage relationship. Now, people can recover. Repentance is possible. But when a person damages his or her marriage by being unfaithful, then that is something that is very difficult to overcome and for people to regain trust in their marriage. But people look at a law like this and they resent being prevented from doing what they want to do. People want, they desire, they have a lust for something outside of the relationship that God has given to them. People just by nature resent limitations, pretty much on every level. When my wife and I were down in Orlando, my sister-in-law, who works for Disney, got all of us passes, free passes, into Epcot Center. And so we enjoyed a day walking around through Epcot, one of the Disney parks in Orlando. But the interesting thing happened. We just got out of parked our car, walked down this through the parking lot to this staging area where you could catch a tram that would take you to the gate. So as you approach this tram loading area, there's a series of these vertical posts about maybe 3 feet apart, about 3 or 4 feet high, just kind of a sort of a to fence you or to prevent you, just to keep you back from where the trams are. And just on this side of, away from the road, there was a yellow line painted on the pavement. Now, the man who was organizing the loading of the trams was walking up and down this area where we were gathering, and he was telling everyone, do not step across the yellow line. For your safety, stay behind the yellow line. Guess what everybody did? At least those in the front. My own brother was one of them. As soon as the guy turned his back and walked down to talk to the other side of the group, you put your foot over that line. You stand up real close to it, and you stand on the line and put your toes just over the edge of it. You're not supposed to do it, so that's what you're going to do. People want to step across the yellow line, and they do that in many different areas of their life, including in marriage. They see something that they want, that they desire, that they'd like to enjoy, and they don't care what the law says. No one's going to know. They can do whatever they want to do. We stayed in a condominium at the feast and on the ninth floor. Beautiful view of the Gulf and of the beach below. And there was a sliding glass door off the living room. You step out onto a little patio or deck area. What a view from that point. But you know what? There was an obstacle that prevented me from going as far as I could have gone. It's called a railing. And it kept me from going over the edge of that balcony. Boy, that's frustrating. We've learned, we've heard this analogy so many times before, that God's law is not a fence, it's a guardrail. It prevents us from hurting ourselves. If that railing hadn't been there, frankly, I would not have gone out on that balcony. I don't like high places. And I would not have been safe being on the balcony. But as it is, I could walk up just within a few inches of this 90-foot drop to the ground below, and I was perfectly safe because I had this railing holding me back. When we recognize God's law for what it is, it prevents us from hurting or even killing ourselves. But people usually don't see it that way. They see it as something that prevents them from something they want. They want to step across that yellow line and do what they want to do. And God giving us free choice allows that to happen. A point to learn is that if we want to have a pleasant life, we have to learn to color inside the lines. We have to learn to stay within the boundaries that God has set. Not committing adultery preserves our families and our marriages. Now, we know that very well. As church members, as members of God's church, we're not involved in that kind of a lifestyle, but we see it all around us. Jesus took it a step further, of course, in Matthew 5, verses 27 and 28. He pointed out that even though it would obviously be more damaging to literally and physically commit adultery, adultery is also a spiritual matter, a mental problem. If we commit adultery in our minds or have that lust for someone other than our own spouse, a desire for them, then that is a form of adultery. That's where society plays a lot of games with us today. I mean, you see, we're surrounded by sexuality. Everywhere you look has something to do with sexuality. And, you know, pornography is so readily available. People can look at and see whatever they want. Again, I trust that we as God's people are not involved in those kinds of entertainment, But the point is that Satan has laid that out in his society, made it possible as a temptation for those who would be led away from and step outside of the guardrail that protects marriage and protects our families. Exodus chapter 20 again, this time verse 17. Exodus chapter 20, verse 17. See, this follows up right in line with this, the commandment that Jesus gave in Matthew 5 about a spiritual or mental form of adultery. Exodus 20, 17, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. The commandment is not against coveting specific items or things. It's about coveting in general. Coveting means to desire or delight in something that's not yours. To have a strong desire for something that is not yours. That's the way that the word means in this context. We are not to have a desire for something that belongs to someone else. That's what the command is. It's a very, we talk about the laws primarily in the Ten Commandments being physical in nature, but this is a very mental, spiritual law. Not to covet, not to desire something that's not ours to have. In the New Testament, we're told a number of times to be content with what God has given to us. And so this is a mental battle that we not wish for something else and not extend ourselves beyond what God has given to us. That's what one of the primary sources of mistakes and sinfulness is, to take something that God has given to us as a blessing and exaggerate it out of proportion. And people do that often in the area of marriage or sexuality. Proverbs 5, verse 15. Proverbs chapter 5, verse 15. Again, immorality is common in our society. It's all around us. We live in a liberal world. Among many young adults, casual sexual relationships are just part of dating. It's just what people do when they date. And it's not considered wrong. What people do with their lives is just considered a choice. God has given us the yellow line. God has given us the guardrail. He tells us what is not just a choice, but what is wrong. Proverbs 5, I want to read verses 15 through 21. I'm going to read this from the paraphrased Living Bible. Proverbs 5:15 from the Living Bible. It says, "Drink from your own well, my son. Be faithful and true to your wife. Why should you beget children with women on the street? Why share your children with those outside your home? Be happy, yes, rejoice in the wife of your youth. Let her breasts and tender embrace satisfy you. Let her love alone fill you with delight." Again, God created sexuality, and he created it to be a great source of pleasure in life within marriage. "Why delight yourself with prostitutes, embracing what is not yours? God is watching. God is closely watching you, and he weighs carefully everything you do." God is aware of the choices we make. God is aware of where we stand in relation to that yellow line, whether we stay within the confines of his law that are given to us for our own protection. So God has given us a command to not commit adultery, either literally or spiritually or mentally, and also not to desire something that is not ours, that would take us outside of the marriage relationship that he's given to us as such a special gift. A third commandment also protects the marriage and family. Turn back to Exodus 20 again. Verse 12. This commandment also specifically has to do with the family structure and preserving and protecting that relationship. Proverbs 20, verse 12. "Honor your father and your mother." To honor means to hold in high esteem, to value, to respect, and to show affection. To honor is to express appreciation and recognition of another. Honor your father and mother. Value them, respect them, esteem them, and have affection for them. Now, this is not just a command to young children. That's sometimes how it's used. And we do teach our young children to honor their father and mother. But actually, it's really more of an issue and more of a challenge for older children and for adults, because we choose who or what we will honor. It requires us to think about and consider what our parents mean to us, how important they are, and the respect that we ought to have for them. It's interesting that the command is not be honorable to your children. The command is honor your father and your mother. Now, obviously, as parents, we want to be one who our children do honor and can honor. But, you know, kids sometimes, young people, teens, younger children, young adults, don't always have just quite the right standard. And they may choose things that would cause them to dishonor their parents without giving it a lot of thought. Honor your father and mother. You see, if one generation honors and reveres and respects and loves their parents, and that passes on to the next generation, you see how society is stabilized. Satan has created something he calls the generation gap. And there are these vast problems and differences between one generation and the next. You don't understand me. You don't care. You never don't know what it means to have fun. All these things. I said it. I heard it. It's a part of the way Satan has built his society to separate the generations. This command unites the generations. It brings parents and children and grandchildren together when it is obeyed. Do we have a responsibility as parents to be honorable? Of course we do. That's a given. A lot of young people have been damaged by poor parenting. Just this week, you probably heard, a little girl, I think she was 5 months old, died of physical injuries from her parents. And she had a couple of siblings that were older than her, and they also were scarred and damaged from what their parents had inflicted upon them. That's a horrible thing, an unthinkable thing. And yet, it's not unusual in our society. How is a child who grows up in that kind of environment going to learn to honor her father or mother? The two older siblings are faced with growing up, and how are they going to look back on their... When they grow up and they come into contact with God's truth and they're told that God is their father, what does that mean to them based on what they've experienced? You see, we do have a responsibility to be honorable, but we also have a responsibility to recognize the efforts of our parents as they do their best to raise us. We must not damage our own children. That's one level, but another level that's emphasized here is the importance to choose to honor our parents, our mother and our father, and to perpetuate the family structure and unit. You can turn back to Ephesians chapter 5. Paul here, and this is something we'll have to review later. We're out of time today. But Paul reviews the responsibilities that husbands and wives and children have in the family relationship. He begins back in verse 15 or so, talking about the relationship in the church in general and how we as brethren should get along and to care for one another. In verse 21, he says, to submit to one another in the fear of God. That's talking about us and our relationship as brethren, but also leads directly into the next part of his instruction where he talks about family. So family is part of, or one of the things we do in a family, especially in a marriage, is to submit to each other, to be bonded in that level of commitment to one another. So he directs comments to the wives and to the husbands, and then in chapter 6, to children. And in chapter 6, he quotes the commandment we just were looking at, honor your father and mother. He points out this is the first commandment with promise. I only read the first phrase back in Exodus 20, but Paul here finishes it. He says, honor your father and mother that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. You see, again, stable families lead to a stable society filled with blessings and security. It's not a promise that everybody's going to live a long time, but it's talking about the result of a solid and secure family. When society is built on that, then everyone's going to benefit. We're going to prosper from it. I want to also just consider, as we come toward the conclusion here, verses 32 and 33. Because it'll lead into something that I want to talk about as I continue along this same general theme in the future. See, Paul is pointing out that the marriage relationship, as we understand it, as we've come to see it, the way it's revealed to us in the New Testament, we saw it established, we see laws governing it, and now we see in the New Testament more of an explanation of the relationship. How to live together as husband and wife. How to live together as children. How to honor our parents. This all is very confusing to most people. Society doesn't get it. They don't understand how these laws will work. So Paul says here in verse 32, this is a great mystery. The family relationship is a mystery. Remember in Mark 4, Jesus said that the kingdom of God is a mystery. A mystery is a spiritual truth that has been revealed. And the family relationship, the marriage relationship in particular, is a great mystery. And part of that mystery is the relationship between Christ and the church. In other words, our marriages, our families, should reflect the relationship that Jesus Christ has with the church. And within our marriages, if we reflect the way Christ relates to the church, there's no room for abuse of any kind. There's no room for anger. There's no room for separation. There's no place for that. Because it represents the relationship between Jesus Christ and the church. And it opens up a whole level of responsibility that we have. And it's all based on this incredibly wonderful blessing of family and marriage that God created from the very beginning. We have in our lives a protection, security, and safety because we understand and apply God's laws. There are challenges in our marriages, there are problems, there are things to overcome. There are matters that need to be worked on and improved. I think we all can recognize that. But still, even though we have certain areas where we're still working to overcome, we recognize what an incredible blessing God has given to us. How valuable it is. There's nothing more important to us as parents and grandparents than for our children to be blessed. And when we have occasion, we have opportunity, we have this special blessing ceremony that we have for the children. And again, it's the parents who at that moment appreciate it and understand it. We want our children to live productive and stable lives, to have happy and successful and meaningful marriages of their own and families themselves. Because that's what God created, and He created a way for that to happen. We find that God created marriage and the family, and He established laws to protect and preserve them. And it is by and in the marriage and the family relationship that God ultimately blesses our children.